Hello, and welcome to Fidelity Connects, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Portfolio managers Alex Gold and Dr. Judith Feingold join Pamela Ritchie for another Fidelity Connects podcast. As the second wave of the virus hits specific communities, cities, and countries around the globe, Alex Gold and Dr. Judith Feingold discuss the implications of the virus on the global healthcare system. They also talk about the vaccine race. Judith explains how companies who are leading the development of the vaccine will undergo numerous challenges, as some of the vaccine components currently being used in these clinical trials have never been used in this capacity prior and are not approved yet. From an investment standpoint, Alex believes many of these companies have goals to distribute the vaccine on a nonprofit basis, which may hurt their ability to generate higher revenue levels. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
I'm going to just ask you to remind people a little bit of your background, how you came to this position originally. Alex, I'll begin with you, sort of how you ended up being the portfolio manager for this incredible global fund.
Sure. So I am just celebrating my 10-year anniversary, actually, at Fidelity. Prior to that, I spent 3 years at PricewaterhouseCoopers, where I trained as an accountant. And at Fidelity, I spent 7 years as an analyst looking at three completely different sectors. I looked at renewable energy, medical technology, so medtech, and then large cap European banks before being given the opportunity 3 years ago to run the Global Healthcare Fund. And so I very much invest as somebody who looks across different business models and tries to understand the quality of the business. And I'm fortunate to have a team of 12 healthcare analysts at Fidelity based in London, Toronto, Sydney, Shanghai, and Singapore. So we've got a very strong, able team of experts helping me make those decisions.
Fascinating, and sort of that global aspect, as you say. And Judith, remind us, you are a doctor. Just give us a bit of your background of how ultimately you came up through the ranks of the medical profession and then joined Fidelity.
Sure. So I started life as a doctor in the National Health Service in the UK. I worked for almost 8 years in the NHS. I was training as a cardiologist. Before realizing that maybe being a doctor wasn't going to be the life for me, I went off and I was doing a PhD in research at the same time and finished my PhD, and then kind of ventured into the world of healthcare investments, coming straight to Fidelity, where I look predominantly at biotechnology and kind of the drug stock. So I really have the opposite background to Alex's. I'm very kind of, very much in the weeds of the healthcare. That's my background.
Fascinating, absolutely fascinating. So I have to put to you, please, Judith, to give us a little bit of a landscape view of where the vaccine race is at this moment. From what we hear, something will be available by the end of this year, but bring us up to date, please.
Yeah, sure. So the vaccine, critical point probably in the next 1 to 2 months, because we're going to start to see some interim data from the vaccines which are the furthest ahead. So I think that most people have heard of the kind of the Pfizer, Moderna, and AstraZeneca is the three names which are commonly in the press as the furthest ahead. I think taking a step back, it's important to know that there are four different types of vaccine modalities which are in clinical trials at the moment. The three that are furthest ahead are relatively, well, in the case of the messenger RNA vaccines, they're completely new modalities which have never been in the clinic before. I mean, they've never been approved before. So normally, if you were looking at a vaccine phase 3 readout, you'd be looking at over 50% kind of probability of success. So normally when vaccines get to this stage, we know a lot about them. This is a very, very different situation for COVID, because obviously we've taken them much faster into patients. We don't know anything about coronavirus still, and I can go into that in a little bit more detail, but you know, there's a lot of risk adjustments when you go into a trial that we just are kind of guesstimating at this point. And I think it's also important to highlight these are newer vaccines. They are the ones that could be developed first, but you know, it does mean that we're going to have to look really carefully at the safety signals. And you know, there is a question as to how much long-term safety follow-up you really need to getting these into the world population.
So we'll come back for more on that and to highlight some of that. Alex, I just have to ask you the question, are the vaccines sort of as a theme within those companies or you know, writ large, are they investable? Is the vaccine investable or how do you look at that?
That's a good question. And I think to Judith's point, there are a lot of uncertainties at this point when we're assessing the trials and we don't know about the efficacy or the durability of the products and whether they, you know, will ultimately you know, succeed in the marketplace. So from our perspective, when we're assessing the pharmaceutical biotech companies and which ones to invest in, we're looking for good businesses with sort of durable, sustainable growth and free cash flow prospects. And while some of them could have, you know, clearly a very beneficial couple of years if they do hit the right levels needed in the vaccine trials, you know, there's a lot of uncertainties at this stage. So we're reluctant to invest solely by some of the vaccines, vaccine companies, where we also, I think it's important to note, they are going to be given primarily on a non-for-profit basis. And a lot of companies have highlighted this. So that's how we think about it currently.
Judith, I wonder if you can point to, and this also plays into sort of the testing diagnostics, which we'll talk about in a minute, but the capacity to roll out, can you also give us a bit of a, you know, your opinion on how easy it is to roll out testing, but also the vaccine? I mean, how complicated is it?
So complicated. I mean, we've never done anything like this before in life, and no one really knows. I don't think that anyone is really appreciating. I hope some people in government are appreciating how difficult this is going to be. But, you know, we've spoken to some really interesting kind of KOLs and industry executives, and there are certain things that have just, I mean, so first of all, transportation of some of these vaccines, some of the newer vaccines need to be frozen at minus 80 degrees Celsius. That's really going to be an impediment to getting them all around the world. We've spoken to some other KOLs and companies that have said, you know, actually, we're going to have a massive issue with glass. Like, there's not enough glass if you're trying to immunize the whole global population. So there is so many bottlenecks around. This is, you know, I think that the rollout is definitely going to be much more challenging than it might seem when people say, we'll have a vaccine and then you'll get it in Q1 next year.
Right. So we hear sometimes, I mean, maybe more of the healthcare workers or frontline workers, but this is sort of.
Hopefully we can put it together for.
Yeah. Sorry, talking over each other. Alex, I'll ask you to bring us into sort of the world of diagnostics, you know, where you see testing opportunities, the types of testing, for instance. Can you give us a little bit of a rundown there?
Sure. So I think given some of the uncertainties which we have, you know, at the moment, you know, governments and companies around the world are focusing a lot on diagnostic testing to see whether you have COVID or whether you may have had it previously. And I think in the US currently they're doing 800,000 tests on a daily basis, which is obviously a huge number. And throughout the rest of the world, they're also trying to do as many tests as they're, you know, quite, you know, able to do. And so, you know, in our view, when we look at some of the diagnostic companies in the industry, they are already benefiting. They've already got tests on the market that, you know, they're selling for $5 to $20 a test. They've got very high sensitivity and accuracy levels, and they're giving, you know, as a result of that, some companies are, you know, getting revenues of sort of $1.5 billion per quarter at quite high margins, and they've already got tangible benefits, which are on top of already strong and attractive business models. So I think the diagnostic industry is an area that we think is interesting and which has so far been a key beneficiary within that.
And just to go a little bit further onto that or into that area, Alex, I mean, can you see, so government money clearly is going towards the vaccines. There seems to be maybe a few question marks about the profitability from that. But on the testing diagnostic side of things, I mean, can you see large corporations, for instance, you know, buying tests or in order to get people quote unquote back to work, if that's what they're trying to do. Do you see sort of those opportunities that are not as public health based, I guess?
Yeah, that's a good question, because that's increasingly, I think, at the forefront of companies' minds, particularly in the UK, for instance. After a recent push to get people back to the office, our government has just told everyone to stay at home again. And so I think the barrier to people returning to work on a sustainable basis and, you know, with safety in mind, does put an increasing emphasis on companies to take this into their own hands. And you already see, you know, press reports about how Amazon are building out their own testing capacity and wanting to test their workers. And I'm sure they'll be the first of many corporations that will want to utilize these, you know, good diagnostic tests to try and get people safely back to work.
Judith, can I ask you to shed some light on sort of the testing side of things? What are some of the things that you think are quite interesting, or areas that of types of testing that interest you?
You know, we've been mainly focused on the diagnostic testing because obviously even at 800,000 tests a day in the US, and certainly most other areas of the world, you know, testing is being underutilized, and it's probably being utilized in the wrong way as well. You know, we recently had a call with an ex-WHO official, and he just explained things so well. He basically said what people did at the beginning of coronavirus was that they modeled it like flu. And flu basically occurs in waves. So if it's waves, then national lockdowns work. But actually, coronavirus is occurring in outbreaks. And that is why this testing strategy is so important, because if you can find the outbreaks and then you can say who is at that outbreak, and kind of you can really stop these huge waves of spread that we've seen up to this point. So we've really been focusing on that. I mean, the other aspect of testing is antibodies and whether you've had coronavirus or not. This is becoming much more of a kind of less important point, because we're not understanding really what antibodies mean. You know, we're not understanding what level you need to get protection. We're not understanding how long they last. So I think at the moment, everyone's taking a little bit of a breather from that, because if you have them or you're not, we're not really sure what it implies. So, yeah. Right. But just that diagnostic testing market is so underpenetrated, underutilized. I mean, recently some of our company calls have just said if we could make 100 times the amount, we could, you know, like the demand is huge.
The demand is huge. And I love that you're just speaking to an ex-WHO executive. That's so fascinating that you can get on the phone with people from the WHO. Here's a question for you, Judith, rolling in. Are there long-term health implications for people who have recovered from COVID-19 that will impact the health industry? For example, more people relying on inhalers. Interesting.
Really great question. And this is something that I do on a daily basis when I get sent different news articles. So, you know, all of us, we pick up the papers and we're terrified. We see long-term lung damage. And for sure, people that have been on ventilators and had high oxygen requirements in any kind of viral inflammation or infection do get long-term lung damage. So I think that's, you know, quite a sensible. But then we've also seen some really scary things in the last few weeks about heart inflammation, kidneys, et cetera, et cetera. And my opinion at the moment is it's a little bit too early to say, because, you know, if you look at a normal flu or a normal common cold, you get a huge amount of heart inflammation if you go and MRI people's hearts. So what we're seeing is a huge amount of kind of case report data, which is then going into the mainstream mediator and scaring absolutely everybody, including myself. And I have to take a deep breath and say, you know, we really need to see some proper registry impartial kind of trial data reading out. And then we can get a better idea of really the long-term health implications of this. So I'm fairly hesitant at this moment to kind of create a huge amount of hysteria over that.
Alex, telemedicine seems to have just taken, I've been taking my kids to the doctor on the computer. Give us some sense of what this industry might mean going forward.
Yeah, so it's an important question, because if we think about some of the changes that may come about due to COVID, you know, one of the ones that we've seen most significantly has been the rise of telemedicine. And I think a stat which I saw earlier was that, you know, in April, 44% of Medicare fee-for-service patients had a virtual telehealth visit, and that compares to just 0.1% who did that in February. So people are utilising, because they were forced to during the lockdown and pandemic, they are utilising telehealth, and there is the potential for that penetration to significantly increase. And you know, the reason for that is because for low acuity issues or diseases, you can have a call, a telehealth consultation, and if that that diagnostic or that solution is nipped in the bud, then you can save the healthcare system a huge amount of money. If you go, every visit to the ER system costs about $2,000 to the healthcare system in the US. So every visit that may be unnecessary and that can be avoided through telehealth, is beneficial for everybody.
Bring us then into, and Alex, perhaps I'll put this to you first, sort of the policy side of things. Policy is obviously shifting within healthcare. We've got a US debate tonight, presidential debate. We're expecting probably some reference to healthcare. Where do you see policy shifting around the world? And again, that sort of leads to types of investable themes.
Sure. So yes, it's a very personal question. I think healthcare will probably be, front and center of the debate tonight, in particular with, there are reports that Trump is going to emphasize his willingness and desire to overhaul the Affordable Care Act, which Obama, implemented, and the fact that, he's now trying to nominate a Supreme Court replacement, before the US election, makes that, even more contentious as an issue. I do expect rhetoric around ACA appeal, around drug pricing policy to continue to be very prevalent during the debate and, in the run-up to the election. But then we do have to step back as investors, particularly long-term investors, and think, okay, if we, look through the rhetoric and we look through what may actually be achievable, is the US government under either Trump or Biden realistically going to take 20 million people out of coverage, healthcare coverage? What would happen to them? We think ultimately, large parts of the healthcare system are ultimately trying to improve patient outcomes, improve patient, lives. And, they know that the best way to do that is to help reduce costs for the healthcare system and to work with them. So ultimately, we think there may be a lot of rhetoric, but probably not much tangible action. But of course, we'll have to wait and see who wins and what they try to implement.
Right. Is there anything, Judith, some questions about other areas of healthcare that obviously are ticking along to an extent, but I'm curious where you see opportunities or areas to stay away from? I mean, has COVID-19 interrupted trials for cancer, for instance? Or, what are some other areas of healthcare that are moving along well and others that maybe are interrupted?
Yeah, sure. I mean, COVID-19 has, 2020 up to this point, so we haven't even finished 2020, but we've seen some of the highest levels of funding for biotech ever. And as I said, we haven't even finished the year yet. So I think that, with this very substantial early stage biotech funding continuing, although there has been, some trial delays, especially worse than things like cancer trials where you have to go into hospitals and get infusions, I see that the long-term tailwinds are very much there, especially for the biotechnology industry. Similarly, the clinical research organization industry, which runs the trials for the biotechnology industry, again, those are really tangible tailwinds for those two industries. On the opposite side, we've had to deal with an unprecedented level of disruption for the medtech industry. So these are, devices that go in for your, for example, some heart procedures, orthopedic devices, knee replacements, etc. Right at the beginning of the COVID pandemic, all of those non-emergency procedures were obviously halted, and now they're coming back and we're watching very closely how quickly those procedures are resuming. There is definitely a question of, while we still have social distancing in place, can we ever get back to pre-pandemic levels of activity in medtech? Before, you may have filled your waiting room up to the brim. Well, now you can't do that, so you can't roll over the cases as quickly. So these are some of the different kind of dynamics within healthcare that we've been really focusing on.
Alex, bring us a little bit up to date on things like, the hospitals as investments, the companies that run the hospitals. This is largely in the US, but also the insurers. I mean, how are they looking at things, and what are either headwinds or tailwinds to a couple of those areas of healthcare?
Yeah, so their fates are almost intertwined. So the US hospitals are the largest one of which is a listed company called HCA, which is a very good operator. They, you know, they're competing in a difficult industry where a lot of their competitors are non-for-profit or have very low or negative margins already before the pandemic. And what the pandemic did is when you had to stop your elective procedures, which is your, you know, key source of income and profitability, then your revenue base collapsed, but your cost base didn't. Your cost base is relatively fixed. And so the companies did as much as they could to try and offset some costs, but ultimately you have huge negative operating leverage on these businesses when your revenues and your admissions and your surgeries decline. But whilst that is negative for hospitals, and we have seen a strong recovery in recent months, that's actually very positive for the health insurers, because the health insurers take premiums, they, you know, guarantee to, you know, a certain amount of costs, medical costs and benefits. And when people haven't been, you know, going to hospitals, they, you know, that's very profitable for the health insurers. But instead of trying to reap the rewards and profits of that, they have been, you know, it's a very politically sensitive issue. They have been giving rebates back to their customers. They've been helping their suppliers. They've been, you know, in talks with the providers. And I think, you know, the health insurance industry is trying not to be seen quite rightly as making huge profits from trying to help the overall system deal with this pandemic.
So interesting, all the subtleties within that. Judith, some of the research that you take part in is available throughout Fidelity internationally, and I know is used by various portfolio managers and the research teams and so on. I wonder if you can shed light a little bit on the research that you do globally regarding COVID-19. There's this discussion of herd immunity, whether we need the vaccine for that, whether there are countries like India, which is sort of brutal sort of first wave, I guess, of COVID-19, but some say they'll have less of a second wave. Can you give us some parameters of this discussion and how your research works?
Sure. So at the beginning of the coronavirus outbreak, you know, the amount of work that was, you know, like the amount of stuff going on globally was absolutely unimaginable. So we set up the COVID-19 working group, and that's an organization which is basically taking healthcare and other analysts from around Fidelity globally, and have all been contributing. So we basically all make kind of siphoned off different parts of work. So our China healthcare analyst will be leading the China you know, COVID research, whereas our industrial analyst will be leading some of the resumptions of activity. You know, I was kind of very much involved in therapeutic and vaccines, etc. Another one of the healthcare analysts was really looking at diagnostics and testing. And this really allowed us all to really go into detail. So not only just to really speak to all the companies and kind of get in there with companies and find out what they were finding, but also just to do the due diligence and to speak to the KOLs and to then, you know, we've put that all together in reports that would come out at the height of it. It was all twice a week. Now I'm pleased to say they're a little bit less frequent, although with the second wave, again, it's heating up a little bit. So that was the general format. Within that, we've done some more specific kind of events. So we've done, for example, a vaccine event where we've spoken to vaccine kind of like ex-heads of vaccines and drug companies. We've also spoken to all of the drug companies that you will see on the news and their CEOs and their CMOs to try to really go into detail. I think it's been one of the times that having had long-standing relationships with these companies has actually really helped and been very beneficial. And within that, I think, as I mentioned, you know, recently we did this kind of public epidemiology event, and we discussed quite at length with this ex-WHO official about herd immunity. And one of the things that I found most fascinating was just his kind of insistence that, you know, it was the wrong term that was put out right at the beginning. It should not be being talked about now. It's just we know so little about this virus that it's just to try to base any kind of public health intervention on this is the wrong thing. So, you know, what does herd immunity mean? What level of antibodies should we be going for? How long do antibodies last for herd immunity? Antibodies are made by B cells, but we know that T cells are also really important for immunity. So should that be going into herd immunity? And for measles, to get herd immunity, you need to get 98% to 99%, whereas of the population, the immunized are infected. Whereas for a flu, maybe it's 60 to 70%. Well, coronavirus, is it going to be to the flu levels or to the measles levels? So he really, I think, kind of made some very, very valid thought that actually this was just something that was put out there in the heat of the moment, and for some reason is still going around, that very much is not a terminology that we should, we shouldn't be aiming for that level of herd, it's not really the right term with what we know at the moment.
We have to sort of find some comfort in the fact that we don't know yet. We're still, obviously everyone's still researching.
Exactly, yeah.
Alex, can you let us know on, what sort of, we've been talking a lot about technicals within the market and whether we've seen a technical pullback in markets of late. This has to do with, certainly more of the tech shares. But within the healthcare industry and within the sector, do you see a lot of speculation going on, Alex? Is that, do you worry about that? Do you invest around it? How do you look at that?
So I think, when I look at the year-to-date data in terms of the performance of the healthcare sector globally, of which about 65% is in the US, the healthcare sector is seen as one of the winners from COVID, but actually it's only up, 2.5% as at the end of last week versus the global index, which is down about 2%. So it's only modestly outperformed. And obviously that's trailed way behind the likes of the tech industry. And I think a lot of the reason for that, and we have seen a bit of weakness recently, is due to the US elections. And, every 4 years, healthcare is an important topic because it consumes 17 to 18% of GDP in terms of its costs. Despite very attractive underlying fundamentals, into an election year and in an election, month now, effectively next month, the sector, does become more volatile. So, we're trying to look through that and, identify businesses to own for the long term. But, that has certainly been a factor, in recent months.
Judith, I'll end with you. So are there sort of some final thoughts that you just want to, wear a mask, social distance, wash your hands. Is that sort of where we're going, or what else can we do?
At the moment, that's about it. But, I'm very hopeful that in the next few months, we're going to see some, at the moment, we still only have the one drug, really, remdesivir, and also steroids. So we're still really in the very initial stages. I'm really interested to see some of the vaccine trials read out. I'm looking for whether they decrease cases or just decrease the severity of cases when you're infected. I'm also really excited still to see some of the therapeutic antibody data read out, because really what I'm looking for, to be honest, is a better efficacy than remdesivir, which didn't reduce mortality when you gave the drug. So I'm really interested. We're going to start to see these tailored drugs reading out in trials. And, I do think that if we could get some improvements from medication, even just to reduce the severity. So if you're ill, you're less terrified. You can take the drugs, maybe have an infusion. And, we would all be less, I think that would make a big difference to the way this pandemic is going. So although, maybe some of my comments haven't seemed that uplifting, I actually think that the next 3 months is going to be extremely exciting, and I'm really fingers crossed for some of these data.
Dr. Judith Feingold and Alex Gold, thank you very much for joining us. You've enlightened us all. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. Please visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts. Don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter and subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice.